Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS, and I'm back from paternity leave after the birth of lovely baby Phoebe. Thank you to Thea and Lucy for holding the fort here. They are now, needless to say, on holiday, which, as regular listeners will know, is something of a vocation for Thea. So with me today is Minister of Fun at the TLS, Roz Dineen. Hello, Roz.
Hello, Stig.
Is it fair to say that Thea's on holiday?
Thea is not on holiday.
She's already emailed to say, you're not allowed to say I'm on holiday.
She's not on holiday. Well, she's at the BBC.
Allegedly advocating for this podcast.
Talking about this very podcast.
I'm saying that it's my truth.
Oh, I see.
It might not be the truth, but it is my truth that Thea is... She's not here, therefore she's on holiday.
I see.
It's my Cartesian...
Doubting everything.
I'm doubting everything.
Until exactly. Proven otherwise.
Exactly. Well, she can come here next week, but you can at least look her in the eye and say you stuck up for her.
I did. I mean, I would always stick up for Thea.
Make sure you're subscribing to the TLS. You can get all sorts of good deals out there. And please do subscribe to and review this podcast, for we are a needy bunch. Coming up this week, what do you know about Descartes? He thought, therefore he was, of course. He's dubbed the father of modern philosophy. But what else is there? Rather a lot, as Stephen Nadler will tell us. In 1739, Captain Thomas Coram established a foundling hospital for exposed and deserted young children. It's now a museum and gallery, this summer showing Jodie Carey's installation called Sea, which appropriately touches on themes of absence and separation. En Liang Kong is in the studio to explain more. René Descartes is a familiar figure, so familiar that, like Beyoncé, he's known often only by one name, or like Dickens and Shakespeare as an adjective, Cartesian. He's the father of modern philosophy, the man who came up with the epigrammatic cogito ergo sum, and the champion of mind-body dualism. But, asks Stephen Nadler this week, who is the familiar Descartes really? His philosophy is not as straightforward as often advertised, and nor is his life story. According to Nadler, his various biographies tell us that Descartes was a devout Catholic, a Protestant sympathiser, an atheist, a solitary thinker, a political engagé, a soldier, a libertine, a materialist, a sceptic, a Rosicrucian. He was a revolutionary, a diplomat, even a spy. Nadler this week has reviewed Harold Cook's The Young Descartes, which seeks to place the man in his historical setting as a plotter who left Paris for political reasons to settle permanently in the Netherlands. Is that a useful way of considering him? Stephen Nadler is on the line to tell us. Stephen, hello.
Good morning. Or good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good evening. It's on a podcast, so people will have it consuming this at all hours of the day and night. The identity of Descartes, how fixed is it in the popular mind? And is it as simple as the man who said, I think, therefore I am?
Well, if we're talking about the popular mind, it seems to be pretty fixed. When you mention Descartes, let's say to the general reader, the first thing that comes to mind is I think, therefore I am, and Descartes as the father of modern philosophy, somebody who allegedly broke radically with medieval philosophy and put philosophical and scientific thought on a brand new path. And there's some truth to that. I mean, a lot of these philosophical mythologies are grounded in seeds of truth. But there's so much more to Descartes that if we think of him simply in those terms, we miss what was really important about him, and especially what his contemporaries considered to be his significance.
And what was that?
Well, there was a great deal of continuity. 17th century was, in some ways, a revolutionary period in philosophy, but historical movements don't have these clean breaks and endings. There's a lot of continuity between medieval philosophy and early modern philosophy. If you look at the progress of philosophy in the 17th century, there is progress and there's some backsliding and there's some a great deal of dialectical development, and not all of these so-called modern philosophers are on the same page on even the most basic issues. The thing about Descartes is that if you were to ask contemporaries in the 17th century, who was he, they would probably identify him more with a particular scientific way of looking at the world. We tend to read, and especially in our courses, tend to teach Descartes primarily through the Meditations on First Philosophy, which is perfectly fine. That's where Descartes tackles the problem of knowledge and tries to establish that, contrary to skepticism, real knowledge is possible. And he goes through various exercises, including proving God's existence, to validate the human knowing faculties.
Although not necessarily convincingly to a modern ear, the proof seems to me to be, well, therefore God must just exist almost.
Right, and well, not even to his contemporaries' ears. He was accused, in fact, of being an atheist because his proofs for God's existence were perceived to be so bad that he must have been intentionally trying to persuade people that God does not exist.
And so is he more of a scientist? I think your piece makes the case that is it better to consider him as a scientist rather than, say, a metaphysical philosopher?
Yes, I think that's right. He thought that the epistemological exercise of establishing the foundations of knowledge was something you do once just to establish foundations for the scientific enterprise, and then having shown that the skeptic is wrong and that absolutely certain knowledge is possible, not just knowledge of metaphysical and mathematical and even logical truths, but knowledge of the world around us. Once you've done that and shown that that's possible, now we can get on with the real business of first establishing what are the primary metaphysical truths, what is the soul, what is a body, and then going on to hopefully discover particular explanations of natural phenomena like gravitation, elasticity, the motions of bodies, and so on.
Why is his biography so hard to establish in considering the amount of attention that he's been given, Stephen? Because he's constantly written about, he's constantly talked about, and yet the point that you make in the piece is we don't seem to know that much about him.
I think partly it's just the desire for every new biographer to come up with a particular angle. Some years ago, I believe it was A.C. Grayling who wrote a biography of Descartes claiming that, in fact, what he really was a spy. What's interesting is that in the past 10 to 20 years, which, you know, in the lifetime of philosophical writing, that's a mere moment, we've had seven or eight biographies of Descartes come out. And before that, you could count them on, count the biography of Descartes on a single hand. But besides simply trying to find that new angle, I think Descartes himself is kind of cagey. He does not reveal a lot in his correspondence about his personal life. You can't put together a story if you just want the basic facts. Where was he? Who was he hanging out with? What was he working on at this or that time? What was of concern to him? But because of the various sorts of correspondence to whom he was writing, he often told a different story. He often kept things hidden. He was writing to theologians. He was writing to academic philosophers. He was writing to scientists, to musicians, to friends. And when you try to put all this massive material together into a coherent story, I think there are legitimately different ways of looking at it. Some of them go a little too far. The notion that he was a spy, I think, is not well-grounded. On the other hand, Harold Cook's attempt to put Descartes in sort of the social, political, and religious context, I think that's a very important thing to do when writing about somebody like Descartes.
There's an interesting idea in the book, in your piece, that the pursuit of absolute knowledge is the natural reaction of someone who's spent a life in the sort of fickle court society. Was his philosophical project, do you think, motivated by the social political context?
To be honest, I'm a little skeptical of that. I mean, it's an interesting story to try to tell. And in a way, it steps back from the harsher spy story. But I do think that Descartes' primary motivations were not social and political, but philosophical in the broadest sense. Philosophy forever has been not the search necessarily for this or that, the solution to this or that particular problem, but the search for how are we to live a good life? What is it to be a flourishing human being? And how can we increase the quality of our lives? This is the project of Socrates saw it, and Plato and Aristotle in the end. And I think in some ways, if you were to ask Descartes, what is philosophy about? What is its highest goal? It's to improve human life. And he would even say it's to prolong human life. He thought he could discover the secret to prolonging human life much longer than its natural term. Unfortunately, he died when he was in his 50s. He caught a cold up in Stockholm because he was being forced to rise at the ungodly hour of 5 a.m. But him, it was a very practical project, philosophy was, understanding the world, understanding the bodies around us, but also especially understanding the human body, what makes it work, and what makes it flourish.
But did he do that? Because I'm always interested, the mind-body problem seems to be one of those problems that philosophers love to dwell upon because it's unsolvable, unprovable. And he's recognized as a sort of a founding father of the mind-body separation. Did he advance thinking on it such? Has that changed really over the sort of the 300 years that followed?
Well, in one sense, yes. We no longer look for the seat of the soul in the pineal gland.
Yeah, that's true. He didn't either, did he? Did he?
He did, yes. He thought that the pineal gland in the center of the brain was the spot where the soul directly interacted with the body. So the soul is this completely immaterial, unextended substance. And so it can't literally have the shape of the body and be literally extended throughout the body. And the body is unthinking extended matter. But there's this little gland, and the motions of that gland were established by God or nature to have certain effects in the human soul. And on the other hand, certain thoughts and volitions in the soul were to result in certain motions of the gland, and the motions of the gland would direct the animal spirits toward pores in the brain, which would then be carried out through the nerves to the rest of the human body. The interesting thing, though, is that I don't get the sense that Descartes was very troubled by the mind-body problem. It was something that was usually brought up by his correspondents, who wanted to know how he would resolve what seems to be a rather intractable difficulty. How does something that doesn't have shape or extension, how does it causally interact with something that is physical? And he offered various responses to that. But in the end, I think what he was primarily interested in was knowing, how does the human body work? How does the blood circulate? How do the animal spirits make the muscles move? And he saw the human body itself, if you take away the soul, the human body is just a kind of machine like any other body in nature. And I think this is Descartes' real contribution to advancing the science of human anatomy, that the human body is not some special item that stands outside of the ordinary workings of nature.
Steve, I could talk about this forever. I find it constantly fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk to us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Ros, are you interested in this, the mind? I said we had a philosophy issue, and I said philosophers like to ask questions that don't actually matter. That's the point of philosophy, is to say, how does the mind-body interrelate? And of course, you can live your whole life with not caring about the answer to that. It's a problem that is a theoretical problem rather than an actual problem. And philosophers love theoretical problems because no one really gets hurt. They just sort of potter around and offer different theories. Do you care about this? Are you philosophically excited?
It is exciting. It's also interesting how Descartes, as Stephen just told us, Descartes said it in order to get on with his science, in order to get on with his geometry. He gave us this sort of explanation. We've taken so much from it.
Yeah.
We've taken so much.
We still don't have the answer though, do we? We don't know how the mind-body interrelates.
No. I think that one of the reasons Descartes' ideas have been spoken about and way more books written about them in the last decade than before recently is because of things like The Matrix, because that's what he was talking about when he said maybe there's an evil genius running everything. Oh, actually, no, there can't be because God is good.
Yeah.
That evil genius idea, that's The Matrix. It's in so much of our culture, so much of our sci-fi.
And because we've never answered the question, it's still really... I remember Tim Crane, our philosophy editor, he promised me he'd solve the mind-body problem. And
would write,
kind of.
It's quite a big claim. Well,
we're doing the philosophy issue, and I said, will you write about this? And he goes, yes, I'll do it. And I said, oh, you'll solve it. And he sort of went, yes. And so I obviously...
No problem.
Yeah, I took it that he did. And of course, he then wrote this brilliant piece about because there's an argument that simply neural mapping, simply showing changes to the brain state when people have different emotions, for example, demonstrates that there is a physical reality to what's going on in the brain.
Yes.
But that still doesn't answer the question, what is the thing making the brain do that? And how do you then have a feeling as a result of it? How does love exist ephemerally and also as brain matter changes? And no one's cracked that.
No.
At least I'm not aware that they've cracked. Maybe
they will let us know if they have.
People should
maybe.
Let us. Yeah, if you've solved the mind-body problem, like Tim Crane, the philosophy editor of the TLS, do tweet us. Why not?
Yeah, go for it.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In 1704, when Thomas Coram returned to London after 11 years in America, he was shocked by the unprecedented levels of poverty, pollution, and child neglect that he encountered. Life was hard, and parents who were unable to care for their babies due to poverty or illegitimacy had few options. It's estimated that around 1,000 babies a year were abandoned on the streets of London. So Coram wanted to do something about it. He campaigned for 17 years before receiving a royal charter from King George II, which enabled him to establish a foundling hospital to care for and educate abandoned children. From 1741, when the first babies were admitted, to 1954, when the last pupil was placed in foster care, the foundling hospital cared for and educated around 25,000 children. During that time, there's been a strong and continuous link between the foundling hospital and the artistic community of the day. Coram's friend, the artist William Hogarth, encouraged leading artists to donate work to the hospital, and George Friedrich Handel donated an organ and conducted performances of Messiah in the hospital's chapel every year. Today, at the Foundling Hospital Museum on Brunswick Square, you'll find a permanent collection of works by Gainsborough, Reynolds and Hogarth, and for the next month, you'll also encounter a series of installations by the artist Jodie Carey. Carey has looked into the archive of the Foundling Hospital and created various exhibits in response to what she found there. En Leng Kong reviews the exhibition in the TLS this week, and he joins us now. En, can we start by discussing the new exhibition and what you actually encounter when you walk into the museum today? Maybe we could start with the sea.
Yeah, so this is an installation that takes place across the museum's lower gallery. In this piece, Jodie Carey is responding to sort of the history of the traces of the thousands of infants who have passed through the Foundling Hospital from the 18th century up until the middle of the 20th century. And she specifically draws on this history of fabric tokens. So when, in the 18th century, when a baby was taken to the hospital, it would then receive a new name, it would receive a new future, it would receive new training, a new education, it would receive new clothes. So nothing of its previous life was preserved, apart from a fabric token which the mother would cut out of either her clothes or the baby's clothes, and she would take one piece away with her, and she would leave the other to be sort of saved in the hospital's billet books. And there was a hope in that if the family's fortunes changed, they could then at some point return and claim their child again.
And use the fabric to say this is proof that
like Annie.
Yeah. Did that happen ever?
Well, occasionally, but I guess the sad sort of part of the story is that it was quite a rare occurrence still. And so Carey's drawing on that history when she basically has taken thousands of fabric swatches, which she's gathered from sort of secondhand shots, from friends, her own collection, and she's cut them up and coated them in this liquid slip, liquid clay. Mm-hmm. And then they dry and curl into these sort of very delicate leaf-like forms, which she then fired in this kiln that she built herself, this huge kiln that she built in her mother's field. And in the kiln, the material burns off, so it leaves all that's left as a very delicate trace of the texture of the material, of a little button, or, you know, the trace of a hem or stitching. And so essentially what you have is this monumental installation of the negatives left by all these pieces of clothing.
What's the effect?
Well, I mean, I think it's a difficult museum to work with. It's obviously very powerful. It can also lead itself to sentimentality, I think, as well. And I know the museum's sort of been very careful about how it commissions artists to engage with that history. So if you go, if you walk around the collection, you can see other artists who have sort of responded. So there's at the top of the gallery, there's this huge canvas by Michael Craig Martin, which is this sort of multicolored tricycle, which is that sort of quintessential sort of symbol of childhood. And Carey's is much, it's much more understated. It's about, how we remember or memorialize feelings of loss.
Were you moved?
Yeah, very, very. Yes, it's a very powerful piece. But I think, above that, she's making a comment on, the ways in which we choose to build monuments to things, and she has this, she once said about the ways in which we memorialize or build public monuments and sculptures, even though they are designed to inspire a sense of reverence, glory. We actually build public monuments as a way of putting things aside and moving on. They never actually look like the feeling we have when we lose someone.
So it makes it easier to walk away, kind of thing.
I think there's a truth in that there is a sort of act of forgetting in the ways in which we build. That very cold marble-like language which we use in.
But is that necessarily a bad thing? I mean, you can make an argument when you talk about national monuments.
Yeah.
That. Putting things aside from the past is a healthy thing for a society to do. And actually harping back to great military victories or fetishizing the death that goes on in wars isn't a healthy situation. I think memorializing can be helpfully forgetting as well as...
I think it depends on the situation and on the context in which you're building that memorial to. So in 1995, for instance, the German artist Horst Hochheisel had this proposal, this very provocative proposal, for a German memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe, where he actually, his proposal was to blow up the Brandenburg Gate and then ground it into a dust and leave it there with covered up by granite. And that was a provocation, essentially, to how we choose to memorialize loss. And his suggestion was to sort of respond to it with another act of loss, which I think was very powerful, and obviously even more powerful because there's no way that that we would ever, our governments would ever countenance a sort of public sculpture with that kind of concept.
The ethics of sculpture really. Have they always been pressing? Because it seems to me that now we're constantly bombarded with should we have this statue of someone? Should Nelson's column be taken down because he was pro-slavery? Is that an issue that all artists of installations kind of are confronting, the extent to which longevity or memorialization is a positive thing?
Well, I think there's a long history, obviously, of artists working with the idea of the monument. But this is the idea of, sort of building a counter monument to things. So it's not about, pulling down a statue of Rhodes or. And so on. It's actually working in with that language of public memorial or public sculpture, and I think there's an element to which Jodie Carey's sea installation, very much engages with that that language of public sculpture.
There's something quite ritualistic about it all as well. Because you can go on. I went on YouTube and saw. you can see videos of her actually making the work. And it's, you know, there's another work we haven't spoken about yet, The Chord.
Yeah.
Which is, oh, actually, maybe you could describe.
Yeah, so this is Jodi Carey has been working with this process of earth casting, which is this very primitive way of you know, casting a sculpture. And it essentially involves burying an item deep into the ground to create a very primitive mould, and then pouring a molten material into the ground and letting that cool, and then sort of re-excavating it. And it's a very raw, unstable way of casting, but it also has a very kind of primitive power. It almost feels like something's been resurrected when you pull it from the ground. So she's got, if you walk up from the lower gallery, she has a piece called Chord, which is this floor-to-ceiling bronze where she has buried a length of cord in the ground, and then very dangerously poured molten bronze into the soil. And I said, actually, you should theoretically cast bronze in, a foundry. You'd use sand and you'd dry that off properly, because when the molten bronze meets any hint of moisture, it spits very viciously. And it's achieved this incredible effect where it has, it really does. The process of earth casting essentially memorializes the soil in which it's been buried in, and you can see the sort of the way in which the molten metal has sort of spurted in different directions.
And is the point around umbilical cords and cords between
it has that connection, but it's also I think a process in which the artist has been exploring a lot over sort of recent years. So there's another work called Found in the next room, where she's again sort of buried rolls of Hessian cloth, which is often used by sculptors in the practice, and then poured molten plaster in to create these sort of quite eerie looking totem like figures.
When you go and see the exhibition, because we're seeing in the news every day a sort of global climate of child separation. Does that add context and poignancy to your experience, or is your experience of seeing Carey's stuff at the Foundry Museum, is it more all about the past?
Well, when I did see it, I think it happened to coincide with obviously a lot of discussion around child separation policy. Certainly around that time that, there was a lot of evocative imagery in the news, sort of crying children, which some of that may have pushed reform of that policy as well.
But equally,
certainly have power.
Some of that also turned out not to be accurate. Interestingly, the picture I think used by Time magazine of a crying child was a child that was subsequently reunited immediately with the family. I mean, it doesn't change anything, but this issue of accuracy of memorialization, that was a very effective image, the image of the crying child, but it was a true reflection of the policy, but it wasn't a true reflection of reality.
Well, and also I think the dangers in that kind of imagery is that they're often involving children caught up in huge international sort of conflicts or disputes, and you can see it in image of Aylin Kurdi, which
this was the refugee child who was then on a beach, and the picture was sort of broadcast around the world,
right? Yeah. Recently we've been seeing another child, the Palestinian Ahad Tamimi as well. So, these are essentially children who are, in a way, the images have been exploited on a sort of mass media level. And then several years on, those images of the refugee crisis, for instance, they don't really ignite newspaper headlines in the way that they did, 3 years ago.
And actually, even at the time, I was fascinated by the reaction to that picture didn't change public opinion about refugees. No one cared about refugees until they saw this dead child. But the point is, if you actually looked at the opinion polls a week after the British collective societal view of refugees was no more warm or welcoming after that image.
So there's a transience to those images, and also there is, you're right to sort of, there's a artist may, can, is often lends itself to sort of artists thinking about how they might respond to infants and loss. So even with the image of Aidan Kurdi, you know, the Chinese artist Ai Weiwei infamously recreated the pose on a beach in a series of photographs, and you know from my point of view, it was a deeply exploitative way of responding to that image of crisis. This has a different history, of course, but I do admire the way in which it has approached a subject that could, you know, could so easily become kitsch or sentimental, and done something very interesting in terms of sort of working with the language of memorials and monumentality.
It's a fascinating subject, and thank you so much for joining us. It's Jodie Carey's Sea, which is at the Foundling Museum in London until September the 2nd. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to En Liang Kong and Stephen Nadler. Thank you to Roz too.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Do make sure you pick up the paper, which has a focus on poetry this week. Next week, we turn our attention to Asia and the Pacific, among many other things, including psychedelic drugs. Toby Lichting's been writing about that. Anything, any experiences of psychedelic drugs you want to share?
Are they the ones that make you see things?
I think so, yes.
I don't need them.
You don't need them. I don't know whether Toby's written a whole piece about it, so he's going to have to come to this podcast and talk about drugs. I asked Lucy, I think, a couple of weeks ago about whether she
was shifty.
She was shifty. Yeah. Unlike you there, which was completely confident and plausible. Yeah, Lucy, she was so shifty, wasn't
she? No, she's not. She wasn't shifty. Anyway, I see unusual things, you know, without any help. Yeah.
Well, shall we get Toby on and ask him about it?
Yeah.
That's a good idea. Lovely. That's Toby Lichtig here next week. Until then, from Roz and from me, goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.